On July 29th, 1967, the USS Forrestal, CVA 59, experienced a severe fire while operating on Yankee Station off the coast of North Vietnam that killed 134 sailors, injured 161 more, and destroyed 21 aircraft. This was, and remains, the second worst loss of life in U.S. naval history since World War II. The disaster resulted in a very long list of lessons learned, many of which are probably better classified as lessons forgotten from the carrier fires of World War II. This time, though, there was a very intentional institutional effort to cement these lessons into the Navy's damage control psyche, training, and procedures, which transformed the U.S. Navy's approach to firefighting, to damage control, and to ordnance handling in the 50 years since the Forrestal disaster. At 10:50 in the morning, the Forrestal commenced the early launch of two refueling tankers in preparation for an 1100 launch of a 24-plane Alpha Strike against North Vietnamese positions. This was the second major strike package of the day. While the carrier air wing was maneuvering on the flight deck in preparation for launch, an F-4B Phantom II interceptor pilot switched from external to internal power. Some flaw in the plane's electrical systems triggered multiple electrical malfunctions, one of which ignited four 5-inch Mark 32 Zuni unguided rockets. These rockets took off from the F-4B, sitting on the Forrestal's flight deck, crossed the flight deck on the level, and hit an A-4E Skyhawk light attack aircraft, piloted by Lieutenant Commander Fred White, rupturing its fuel tank, igniting the fuel, and initiating the fire. Although there is some ambiguity in eyewitness accounts as to whether the rocket actually hit the A-4E next to it, piloted by none other than future Senator and then Lieutenant Commander John McCain, before glancing off and igniting the other aircraft's fuel tank. Regardless, shrapnel ripped into both aircraft, and both were immediately sprayed by fuel, and a pool of fuel ignited between them and under John McCain and Lieutenant Commander White's aircraft. Both pilots initially escaped from the flames around their aircraft as the damage control sirens began to sound throughout the ship. The impact of the Zuni rocket hit dislodged at least one, but probably two, 1,000-pound bombs from the A-4Es, which fell into the spreading flames. Now, these particular bombs were decades old and had been dredged up from deep storage because of the intense demand for bombs in the air war against North Vietnam. If you remember from the Vietnam Blue Water episode, where I talk a lot about the carrier-based bombing campaigns against Vietnam, more than 7.5 million tons of bombs were dropped on Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia throughout the Vietnam War era, which is more than twice the tonnage dropped by all sides combined during World War II, which just gives you an idea of the intensity of the bombing, most of it done from carriers. This massive bomb demand meant that there was no way the industrial base could supply everything the military demanded at any price. So the outdated AN Mark 65 1,000-pound bombs were being used in place of the more modern and safe Mark 83s. These AN Mark 65s started production in 1939 and were World War II and Korean War staples, but had last been produced in the 50s. And the excess had been put into deep storage in case of a national emergency, and Vietnam was considered one of these. And so it's no surprise to me that the poor condition of these bombs was recognized and noted by the Forrestal's captain, John Belling. And according to the ship's ordnance officer, these bombs were an immediate danger to the ship and should be jettisoned overboard. But doing that meant that the ship would fail in its primary mission, and so reluctantly, the bombs are loaded onto planes, and throughout the summer of 1967, were continuously used for bombing run after bombing run after bombing run ashore. After the fire began to spread, Damage Control Team 8, led by Chief Aviation Bosun's Mate Gerald Ferrier, rushed onto the scene. This was one of the few damage control teams that had received specialized flight deck training, and they immediately reacted to the fire. Based on their training with Mark 83 bombs, the damage control teams expected to have approximately 10 minutes to extinguish the fire around the bombs before there was any risk of the case melting, so that's the steel around the actual explosives, or the bomb cooking off. These Mark 83 bombs are designed well, in that if there was a fire, they weren't expected to explode. If anything, there might be a very, very small explosion, but generally they would just burn unless they were ignited by the trigger, which would not be ignited by fire. You know, it's a really smart design. And so knowing this, Chief Ferrier immediately smothered the bombs with a PKP chemical extinguisher in order to cool them off. However, these old AM Mark 65 1,000-pound bombs were not only unstable, but during their decades in storage, the chemical composition had changed to make the explosions even bigger and more powerful. And so a little more than 1 minute after the fire started, the first bomb's casing fractured open. Chief Ferrier immediately ordered the team to withdraw because he knew that there could be an imminent cook-off and explosion. And he was right, because 1 minute and 34 seconds later, the bomb exploded, killing Chief Ferrier and almost the entire Specialized Damage Control Team 8, leaving just three survivors who were all severely injured. The same explosion killed Lieutenant Commander White, who piloted the Phantom 2, which was hit, and started the whole fire. A second bomb exploded 9 seconds later and started the chain reaction that would cause a two-day damage control disaster. Down below, fuel was flowing through holes in the flight deck. Fire followed, spreading to the O3, O2, and O1 decks, and to the aft end of Hangar Bay 3. Sailors trapped between spreading flames and the edge of the flight deck took the long jump overboard, joining several of their shipmates who had been blown over the side by the explosions. These overboard sailors clung together and were rescued by helicopters from the nearby carrier Oriskany and the Forestall's two escort destroyers who were on Yankee Station together with them. The sick bay of the Forestall quickly filled up, and an emergency hospital was set up on the ship's forecastle. USS Repose, a hospital ship, got underway from Da Nang within an hour of the first explosion, and news reached Captain Belling that it would rendezvous with the Forestall within a day. Both Lieutenant Commander White and Lieutenant Commander McCain's A-4s, fully fueled, loaded with ordnance, and ready to start on their bombing runs, were destroyed by the blast. Per the initial mishap board, quote, "In a period of 4 minutes, seven major explosions shook the entire ship, and some 40,000 gallons of jet fuel from aircraft spotted on the flight deck was ignited and contributed to the damage. Firefighting teams, pilots, and squadron personnel on deck were knocked down, injured, or killed by the series of explosions. The fire spread with the first explosion to every aircraft across the entire after part of the flight deck. Seven holes were ripped through the flight deck from explosions of 750, 500-pound, and 1,000-pound bombs. Rockets and 20-millimeter shells shot across the deck, and ejection seats fired into the air." End quote. Later analysis would go on to indicate that at least 9 bombs exploded on the flight deck within that first 5 minutes. 8 of them were old AN Mark 65 1,000-pounders. The other bombs on the flight deck, the new ones, performed as designed and didn't detonate during the fire. And to put some of these bombs exploding in perspective, it is a miracle and good engineering that this didn't sink the carrier outright. When going through my memory of World War II era carrier strikes, carriers were routinely taken out by far fewer 500 or 1,000-pound bomb hits. There's some obvious differences, including that the bombs dropped by dive bombers often penetrated deep into the hull of the ship before exploding, but I still don't think I have ever read of a ship absorbing that many bomb blasts and surviving under any circumstances. There's some truly horrific video and photos taken during the fire, because the Forestall was equipped with deck cameras, and so there was a lot of footage that you can find out there on YouTube of the firefighting in real time. You can see the sailors jumping, you can see them running away from explosions and then running right back with hoses immediately afterwards. And some of them don't have any shirts on or any sort of protective gear whatsoever. You can see the huge clouds of thick black smoke from burning decks, and you can see the destroyer USS Rupertus coming alongside to lend her hoses to the fight. And you can see the helicopters from the carriers Oriskany and Bahama Shard arriving with fresh DC crews and supplies to finish the fight and to take the overflow wounded back to their surgeons and sick bays. And of course, you can later see the flag-draped body bags of the sailors lost to the fire and the explosions, surrounded by their shipmates in dress whites. But while the fight was going on, amid the bomb blasts, most of the pilots on the aft flight deck were able to escape, but two more were killed in the explosions. John McCain was helping another pilot, who was on fire, when the first explosion occurred, and he barely escaped by rolling onto the port catwalk as other bombs exploded. He then proceeded to assist ordnance men on the hangar deck in jettisoning bombs over the side to prevent them from exploding as well. Here's a contemporary interview with John McCain, talking about his experience in the forestall fire.
I turned around and saw another pilot who was leaving his aircraft, and he was had also jumped much the same way I did, only he had got a little more fuel on him and he was on fire. I turned and ran towards him. At the same time, people were headed towards the fire with fire hoses. I then, as I headed towards him, I got about 10 feet from him and the first bomb exploded. And this knocked me about 10 feet, and everyone who had been near me were all either badly maimed or killed from this explosion.
The bomb blast blew large holes in the flight deck, and the flaming fuel poured down to the hangar bay and berthing compartments at the aft end of the ship, which accounted for many of the casualties. Some of the burning fuel was spread by untrained hose teams who were using water on fuel, a Class Bravo fire. In some cases, they were just washing away the AFFF, which is aqueous film-forming foam, which is laid by other teams and allowed the fire to reignite. This is a very basic damage control 101 level mistake and a major cause for the fire spreading out of control like it did. You can see how it happened. If the sailors were not given real damage control training, and with most of the specialists dead in the first initial explosion, it seems like the obvious thing to do. Spray the fire and the oil with water, right? But just like an oil fire on your stove, you kill a gas or oil fire by depriving it of oxygen. At home, that might mean putting a lid on the pan, but on a ship, this is done using a special foam mixing station, which takes highly concentrated AFFF, that's the aqueous film-forming foam, which is essentially just soap concentrate, dilutes it down with seawater, and then sprays this foamy water onto the fuel in the form of a super unfun foam party, basically. The death and incapacitation of the entire specialized firefighting team, Damage Control Team 8, and the initial explosion had a really critical impact. By the end of World War II, as a result of the lessons learned during that war, most sailors on ships had received a lot of specialized firefighting training. But by 1967, the U.S. Navy had reverted to the old Japanese model, where specialized, highly trained damage control and firefighting teams were expected to rush to the scene of the attack. But most of the crew didn't receive more than very, very, very basic damage control training. Why we did that, I literally have no idea, since that seemed to consistently be one of the major advantages that U.S. Navy ships had over their Japanese counterparts in terms of ability to recover from battle damage and save a badly damaged ship by having every single sailor pitch in at least a semi-meaningful way. It probably saved some training money, and the Navy was already hurting for sailors, and especially qualified sailors during the Vietnam era. But the end result of that decision was that during several Vietnam-era shipboard fires, heroic but uncoordinated and generally ineffective and sometimes counterproductive efforts by untrained hose teams caused far more damage than they would have if they had been trained in damage control tactics. Nevertheless, the forestall's ad hoc firefighting teams of sailors had the fire on the flight deck out by 12:15. However, the fire below decks, spread by the burning fuel on top of the dripping water that was coming down, was much more difficult to put out. And the last one wasn't extinguished until 0400 the next day. Damage to the forestall was so severe that she had to come off Yankee Station for almost a year-long repair period. During this refit, she was given the now standard washdown system, which floods the flight deck with foam or water. And in the event of a similar flight deck fire today, there's a Christmas tree green and red lever on the bridge that the OD or the captain can pull to start huge automatic pumps, which pump seawater through pre-aligned AFFF mixing stations and coat the entire flight deck in foam and stop a similar fuel fire in its tracks. This is just one of the many changes that have been permanently incorporated into the U.S. Navy's damage control framework. And as I've heard many times before, every single procedure is written in blood. In this case, that is certainly one of them. The Navy investigation eventually absolved Captain Belling of responsibility for the fire, but his career at sea was over. This is the nature of leading a Navy ship, though, because almost anything that goes wrong, no matter how out of your control it is nonetheless the responsibility of the captain. There's always something more that the captain could have done or should have done, and the standard, with you as the latest example, has to be upheld. Hopefully the next guy is a little more inspired to be a tiny bit more vigilant. That's the thinking, at least. Captain Belling had been in his cabin at the time of the Zuni rocket misfire and supervised the damage control effort in his t-shirt, displaying considerable leadership throughout the entire harrowing 11-hour damage control ordeal. Nonetheless, the initial board of investigation stated that, quote, poor and outdated doctrinal and technical documentation of ordnance and aircraft, equipment, and procedures, evident at all levels of command, was a contributing cause to the accidental rocket firing, end quote. At the time, this wasn't unique to the Forestall in any manner. But nonetheless, the Commander-in-Chief of the Atlantic Fleet disagreed with the final investigation report, and especially the part that cleared Captain Belling. And so he initially was given a letter of reprimand, which was then removed by the CNO. Captain Belling did go on to make Admiral, but he was never given command at sea again. The Forestall disaster was the second of three very serious U.S. Navy carrier fires in the 1960s. The first was the Oriskany, which suffered a fire on October 26, 1966, again on Yankee Station, that killed 44 and injured 138 when a magnesium parachute flare was accidentally ignited due to human error, and a panicked sailor threw it back into the magnesium storage locker instead of overboard. Most of the dead were pilots killed by the toxic smoke in their sleep. And the second was the Forestall disaster. The third occurred when the Enterprise, the first nuclear carrier, on January 14, 1969, was en route to Vietnam. This fire killed 28, injured 314, and destroyed 15 aircraft when hot exhausts from an aircraft starter ignited another Zuni rocket and started a series of explosions. In the case of the Enterprise, though, the lessons learned from the Forestall and not having the old, unstable ordnance on board resulted in that fire being contained far more rapidly with far fewer casualties. The Forestall fire resulted in many lessons learned and lessons relearned, as I mentioned, and really was the trigger that caused significant change to the U.S. Navy's training and damage control mindset. The biggest change was the reinstitution of firefighting training for all crew members, and that's still true today. Another was the installation of the flight deck washdown systems, which I mentioned. Another was the establishment of the Weapon System Explosive Safety Review Board, which would have today prevented a similarly unstable piece of ordnance from being loaded aboard a warship. And finally, one of the biggest things was simply culture. There is a pervasive damage control culture aboard U.S. Navy ships, and that is utterly different from how it was during Vietnam. Just to wrap up a few side stories here, 3 months later, on October 26th, 1967, flying from his reassigned ship, USS Oriskany, Lieutenant Commander John McCain was shot down over North Vietnam on his 23rd bombing mission. He'd be a guest at the Hanoi Hilton for the next 5.5 years. The Farrier Firefighting School Learning Site in Norfolk, Virginia, is named after Chief Aviation Bosun Mate Gerald W. Farrier, the sailor who died in the initial explosion in an attempt to delay the detonation of ordnance, using the only tool he had available with him, a single purple PKP extinguisher. It was a absolutely true act of heroism. Today you can see the names of the 134 sailors who died aboard the Forestall, including Lieutenant Commander John White, on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. As always, if you have enjoyed this episode, please rate, subscribe, email me at usnavalhistorypodcast@gmail.com. And until next time, fair winds and following seas.